Well, you know, anticipating the market's gyrations has never been easy, and it's only getting harder and harder. So I've asked Stephen Goldberg from Kiplinger to join me. He just wrote about this recently, so I thought he and I could have a good discussion about what we both know about the subject of market timing. Hey, Stephen, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
You know, this sentence that you wrote, which really got my attention because I had the exact same experience. You write that when you woke up in the morning after the Brexit announcement, you thought, in my words anyway, uh-oh, this is going to be bad. And I felt the same way. It's like, you know, you can have all these other fake problems that the media talks about, but Brexit is, you know, the ripping apart of two economies. That sounded pretty serious to me. And it was. For a whole two trading days, the stocks did sell off, but then it changed its mind and recovered all its losses. Isn't this just an example about how impossible it is to time the market?
It sure is. I mean, I had one of my clients, actually one of my smarter clients, I was checking my computer and he put in sell orders for about $500,000. Mm. And I called up and, you know, I didn't know what was going on. This was before the Brexit voting was completed. So he got it right. And I thought he was a genius.
Yeah.
But I knew, you know, from years and decades of doing this, that you just can't tell how the markets are going to react to stuff. You just can't tell.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of interesting, and again, I don't know anything about you and your client, but that he didn't contact you first. He just, like, in a sense, maybe he was like, you know, I'm a little ashamed of this, but I'm going to do it anyway because I'm frightened.
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, it seems like market timing should work because we all, you know, can look back at events and go, oh, yeah, you know, sure, you know, there was a technology bubble in 2000. And oh yeah, you know, the real estate market was overheated. Prices were going up like crazy. That was going to crash. But I guess the definition of a bubble is that, you know, it's only obvious in hindsight. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's really true. I think it's really hard for people to live with uncertainty. I mean, I talk to clients all the time and to readers, and they want to know what you think. They want to know which way the market is likely to go.
Yeah.
And it's just very hard for us to, I think as humans, it's just not what we're used to doing, to saying we don't know.
We always have an explanation for what has happened.
Sure.
That seems to be a human characteristic, right? So at the end of the day, the reporters on CNBC, they'll go, well, the market went down because.
Yeah, I've always thought, I mean, my background's in journalism, of course, and I've always thought one of the worst jobs in the world would be writing the daily market wrap-up story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you really don't have any idea why the market went up or down. I mean, you have some, but you're making it up.
Yeah, I mean, is it facetious to say that it's more sellers than buyers? You know, I mean, more selling pressure in a given day? I mean, you look at a stock, and you look and it goes down in price or it goes up in price. And sometimes when it goes up, there is news that it's reacting to. But, you know, sometimes you look at a stock that you own and it goes down and you search and search for news reports on why it's gone down. And there's just nothing, even in the most remote corners of the press, a little story somewhere about something. There's nothing. And it's just that someone decided to unload shares for whatever reason, and buyers weren't willing to step up to the plate, and the stock goes down.
What I think has happened, too, is that there's so much more information out there now, and everybody can get access to it, that it's harder than ever to beat the market. I don't know if you've heard the story, but any baseball fan knows that Ted Williams hit 406 in 1941, and no one's hit 400 since. And the theory is, and I think it's true, that the reason nobody's hit 400 since is because all the players are better. So the pitchers are better, the fielders are better, the hitters are better. So you're not likely to get someone quite as outstanding. And the same thing happens in the market, because for every seller, there's a buyer. And there's so much information available to all of us that in the past you couldn't get, that it really makes low-cost index funds much more attractive.
Yeah. I'm speaking with Stephen Goldberg from Kiplinger, and he's written an article about timing the stock market. It's entitled, timing the stock market at your peril. And we're just talking about this whole concept of, you know, this desire or feel that, gosh, you know, you should be able to time the market. And there's also all these people out there selling you the promise of being able to do so. But, you know, when you've got experience, you know, I've been doing this for 35 years and Stephen's been doing it a long time too. Actually, you said in your little piece that you were a market timer at once, weren't you?
Yeah, when I started in 1982, I was a market timer. And my market timer was pretty good. I got out in 1987, 2 days before the market crashed. It went down, was it 23%?
Yeah, you must have felt pretty smart, huh?
Yeah, I felt like a genius. Mm-hmm. And I felt like my market timer was a genius. But it also kept me out of the market for more than a year.
Yeah.
And stock prices, I thought we were going to have a depression in 1987.
I remember that. I was there. Actually, I started in 81.
Uh-huh.
So we're very close to that. And I remember experiencing that for the first time. And all you can think of were the headlines from the Wall Street Journal, right, you know, during the market crash of 29, you know, Wall Street lays an egg, you know, and it was the beginning of the depression. And you go, is this the beginning of the depression? Everybody was stunned and frozen at that
right.
time. Yeah. You know, the other challenge, I think, is that you may be right, but to actually get the timing right is hard. So let me give you an example. During 96, Alan Greenspan gave his famous speech about irrational exuberance, right? So it was obvious to him and to others that the stock market had just kept going up double digits, and that when you looked at valuations, they were extremely high. But it took 39 months after that announcement for the shares to actually peak. That's over 3 years. So you could have been out of the market for those complete 3 years feeling kind of like a dummy and frustrated because you're in cash expecting the market to crash and the market goes up and up and up and up. So you could be right in terms of direction, but wrong in terms of timing.
Yeah, I've talked to a lot of people who got out in 2008,
yeah.
right about the time when Lehman went under.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been out ever since, waiting for the market to correct.
Yeah, no, that's a sad thing, isn't it?
Yeah. But I do think there are some ways you can position your investments to profit from cheap valuations.
Okay, so let's talk about some of those. Give me an idea.
So, for example, in 96, I think to have sold some of the tech stocks and bought some of the more value-oriented stocks and some of the foreign stocks would have worked. They were so much cheaper.
Yeah, no, there's no question. But don't you remember the fact that everybody was saying that Warren Buffett was just a dinosaur from the past?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I remember watching CNBC and someone getting on and going, I mean, let's face it, Warren Buffett likes Coca-Cola. I mean, really, sugar water, you know? And he looked really stupid for a number of years. So,
yeah.
You still may be right, Stephen, and I'm surely not arguing with you. I'm just discussing this point that you would still have been out of favor. Maybe your stocks would have gone up, but while these tech stocks were going up 20-something percent, maybe you were going up 6, 7, 8, 9%.
Well, that's why the actual intellectual part of investing isn't really very hard.
Yeah.
I mean, the math isn't calculus. It's really pretty simple.
Right.
But the emotional part of investing is terribly hard. Being on the sidelines or in slower moving stocks when the tech stocks were going straight up is really
sure.
hard.
Yeah.
Currently,
right.
I think the real values are in foreign stocks and also in emerging markets. And yet they've done terribly. U.S. stocks have beaten foreign stocks for, is it 3 or 4 or 5 years now?
Yes.
Running?
Yeah.
So every foreign stock you've owned has been a mistake.
That's right. So you even own the index fund of foreign stocks, the EFI index, and it's just been a terrible disappointment, really. And yet, so you have to somehow be very sure of yourself and believe that your course of action, though while in the heat of battle, the short term, it looks terribly wrong, but in the long term, you've got to be pretty sure it's right. So the idea here is, well, you hold on to foreign stocks anyway, even though year after year after year. And I guess the idea, though, is that once you capitulate, once you throw in the towel, to foreign stocks and you go, you know, I'm getting rid of all of them and I'm going US, that's probably the top of the US market, you know, because you now believe in the US market so much.
Sure.
Because it's gone up and up and up continuously.
Sure. And you hear the argument made today that wasn't made 5 years ago that says, oh, you don't need to own foreign stocks because the U.S. stocks do all this business overseas. And that's true, of course. But you weren't hearing that 5 years ago when foreign stocks were outperforming, when particularly emerging markets were beating everything.
Yeah. Now, this year, emerging markets are killing everything. They're just beating everything.
Yeah. And what we don't know is whether that's just a head fake or whether that's the real beginning of a recovery.
And I guess the operative words you just used is you don't know.
No. But what you do know is that emerging market stocks are still selling for about 11, 12 times earnings.
So when you look at the value you're getting for a dollar invested, the return on that dollar, it's pretty attractive.
Right, right. Where U.S. stocks are pretty pricey.
Yeah. So if you have the patience and you're not looking at it every day, actually, I tell some people, you know, if it upsets you, you know, just don't even look at your statements. Because it's just like buying, if you bought a commercial office building, the price isn't listed every day in the paper.
No.
You're not getting a monthly statement telling you what it's worth. You just have an idea that it's throwing off X dividends or cash flow, and you're hoping that over time it appreciates in value. And if you decide to sell it, it's very hard to sell. It's very expensive, and it takes a lot of time. You got to find a buyer and so on. So people tend to hold on to their farms, their residences,
sure,
their commercial real estate, and they tend to make money over time. But in stocks, one of the blessings as well as the curse, the blessing is that stocks are liquid, but the curse is also that they're liquid.
Right. No, I mean, there are no headlines. Peter Lynch made this point a long time ago. There are no headlines in the paper saying, you know, Pomerantz house loses 10% in value.
Thank God. No, but you're right. Exactly. And you can't then call your broker and say, sell my house. I mean, well, first of all, where are you going to live? You know, there's a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
That long-term investing and in certain cases, having the illiquidity can actually act behaviorally anyway, towards your behavior can be positive. The fact that you can't actually get out can be a positive, though I still think on balance, liquidity is always better than illiquidity, right?
Well, it depends on the situation. Mm-hmm. It depends on the client, too.
You know, I'm thinking back to the last 5 years, and we had a lot of head fakes, you used that word before, with false alarms. You know, there are periods of time when the media gets on a topic that I think the media can put into attractive sound bites, and it's easy for us all to understand. So, whether it's plunging oil prices, that it's just telling you immediately every day, oil prices are down this or down that. And they're talking about the what ifs, you know, though it could trigger a bear market or Greece's debt. I mean, when did you ever think about the debt in Greece, for goodness sakes, right? But all of a sudden we're thinking about it. And I have clients that come to me and they're saying, you know, I'm scared to invest because of what's going on in Greece. And, you know, what can you really say? You know, it's a country that's not even as big as Delaware, I think. You know, what real effect is that going to have? But my point is that there are a lot of false alarms. And I'd like you to talk about that a little bit.
Well, there are a lot of false alarms, and then there are a lot of times the market just sells off without there being a reason. Mm-hmm. I think what is amazing is we've had really slow growth. We've had 2% GDP growth pretty much the last 10 years. And the market has gone up.
Yeah.
I mean, since the bottom in 2009, the market's gone up. It's without a bear market. This is one of the longest bull markets in history.
All in a world of so-called kind of negative feeling about the economy and the world, and things seem to be not as good today as they have been in years past. And yet the market is basically saying something quite different. So maybe we're just focusing on the wrong things.
Right. Or maybe the Federal Reserve is just keeping the market propped up, and as soon as they start tightening, things are going to fall apart.
Well, that is true.
I don't begin to think I know.
Yeah, no. So nobody really knows. And I think that's the lesson that needs to be learned from this discussion, is that nobody really knows. You know, they say that, you know, don't ever mistake a bull market for genius.
But there is one thing we do know, and that's since 1900, stocks have returned about 10% annualized.
Yeah.
And in that period, we had the Great Depression, we had two world wars,
right,
all kinds of disasters that were smaller.
So buy good quality investments, get diversified. If you're going to buy mutual funds, buy index funds with low costs, low taxes. And you know what? Just hold it and forget it.
I think there's very little reason for people to buy anything but index funds.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've got one investor that agrees with you, and that's Warren Buffett, right? So lesson learned. Of course, successfully timing the markets would be very profitable if you could actually do it, but
right,
you really can't. My guest, Stephen Goldberg from Kiplinger Magazine. Thank you so much for joining us, Stephen.
Thanks for having me.